Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCrit Podcast. Today, we're going to do an episode of Mind of the Resuscitationist, particularly on the issue of the post-resuscitation. We've been talking a ton about what to do to optimize your mind during the actual resus, but what about afterwards? We often ignore this. This episode was already in the works before I went down to the Bahamas for a blood and sand conference. But at that conference, my friend and friend to the MCrit show, Mike Mallon of the Ultrasound Podcast, gave a lecture there called The Day I Didn't Use Ultrasound, and it was phenomenal. Hopefully, Mike is going to put the recording he made of that lecture up on the MCrit podcast, so I'm not going to spoil it because it was heart-wrenching and amazing, and I was just at the edge of my seat for 20 minutes listening to Mike. But one of the things that came out of that lecture was this episode, which was on the back burner. The way I do MCrit is I actually have like 200 possible episodes sitting in my WordPress queue, and I just add to each one's show notes as new articles or new things occur to me, and then I decide one day to just actually record the podcast. And so after Mike's lecture, I said this one has to be put out because it directly touches on a lot of the things Mike mentioned at the end of his talk, and I think it'll segue nicely if Mike does decide to put his talk up. So let's get to it. The post-resuscitation. I did a book club with my buddy Cliff Reed on the book On Combat by Grossman. And this book has really taken off in the resuscitation foam community because it just speaks so much to the things we do. One of the things that came out of that book and book club was the concept of the adrenaline dump. When you are in a stressful situation, you get an enormous surge of stress hormones, norepi, epi, and up to a certain point, those actually make you perform better at a lot of the things we need to get done. You will not be the best suturer of a facial lack, but you probably are thinking better than you would without that hit of stress hormones. And you really don't have a choice in the matter unless you've really worked on your stress management. So when things are really bad, when a patient's crashing in front of you, you're probably going to get that hit, that adrenaline dump. What we just briefly touched on that show, but didn't discuss in depth, is what happens after an adrenaline dump. And what happens afterward is something called the parasympathetic backlash. And I think it's best summed up by a quote from Grossman himself. I quote, "It doesn't take a rocket scientist to guess that a soldier must pay a heavy physiologic price for an enervating process this intense." He's referring to combat, getting the huge epi norepi surge in the course of an actual altercation, but it's the same as a resuscitation. I go on. "The price that the body pays is an equally powerful backlash when the neglected demands of the parasympathetic system become ascendant. This parasympathetic backlash occurs as soon as the danger and excitement are over, and it takes the form of an incredibly powerful weariness and sleepiness on the part of the soldier." Well, there you go. I mean, Napoleon was even more succinct. The moment of greatest vulnerability is the instant immediately after victory. And we all know this. We're all high-fiving because you got that difficult airway. And you sometimes have a failure at that point to really pay attention to what's going on situationally with the patient. So that's the first thing to do to counter parasympathetic backlash, is to understand it's going to happen. And the more adrenalized you were, the more of a backlash you're going to have to deal with afterwards. So step one of dealing with that backlash is to actually get back situational awareness. So you do a scene check, especially in the pre-hospital world, but even in the ED as well. You look around you, 360-degree sweep is what we were taught in the martial arts. You've gotten control of your opponent, and then you look around in all directions to make sure there's not another threat coming. And then, do you need to do anything immediately to stabilize your patient? Do you need to do any post-intubation stuff? Do you need to do any further medical management? And get that all dialed in. Assign someone, preferably someone who didn't take a huge adrenaline hit, to continue to observe and monitor and treat that patient. If you feel now you can break off for a moment, but you still have a patient that needs someone watching them. So often, if I was the one who took the major adrenaline hit, because you know, even though we have residents, it's weird because sometimes you as the attending realize this patient is extraordinarily sick, that if you don't act in the next, you know, 60 seconds and act definitively, they're going to die. And yet the other people in the room sometimes are not really appreciating that. You know, they know the patient's sick, but they don't get just how close this patient came to death. And they might not have the same adrenaline hit. And so passing off the patient temporarily to one of those people, once you've actually decided, you know, there's nothing further you need to do in, you know, the next 5 minutes, is not a bad idea. It goes both ways. We discussed this at the conference as well. Sometimes you'll have other care providers, whether that be a attending from another service or one of the nurses you're dealing with or even one of your residents, and for whatever reason, they've taken an enormous adrenaline hit. They are really scared of what's going on in this patient, but you, due to more familiarity with the situation, more experience, you're not even fazed. I mean, this is nothing to you. This is a patient that you have no fear of how they're going to progress. You know exactly what needs to be done. You've taken no adrenaline hit. Your presence in those situations actually could be annoying to those people. It was a very interesting conversation we had, because if you're totally calm, cool, and collected, they actually may think that you're not appreciating how sick the patient is, when it's actually just the opposite. You not only appreciate exactly what's going on with the patient, but have so many resources to be able to solve the problem that it doesn't even faze you as an issue. I ran into that the second time I did fellowship, where the first time, generally when I was approached by people, I was just as scared as they were. The second time around, there were situations where really, I mean, this didn't even register. It wasn't a blip. I got no adrenaline hit. Those people need to take a break, and you should stay in the room in those circumstances. But basically, if you can hand the patient off after you've done your initial sweep, initial stabilization, then do it. Find someone to watch them, or maybe the patient's left your resus bay. They've gone upstairs. They've gone to the cath lab. Great. What next? All right, now you are thoroughly in the throes of parasympathetic backlash. You got to do a few things. The thing not to do is to see another patient. Mike, actually, when he was telling the story, immediately went to see the patient who'd been waiting with a non-emergent abdominal pain. Don't do that. You're not at your best. That patient is not benefiting from you going to their bedside immediately. And I think we've really fallen into a bad situation in the field of emergency medicine, at least in the U.S. There's this concept that it actually matters how quickly patients are being seen. Now, don't get me wrong. Sick patients should be seen with an immediacy beyond anything else. But patients who are not crashing, patients who are not actually emergently ill, I don't see why we've convinced ourselves that getting people out as quickly as possible is actually a good thing. I actually look at it as a bad thing. The quicker I get patients out, the less time they get observed, the less time they have to declare themselves to be sicker than they are initially showing themselves. I don't quite get it. It doesn't matter to me so much. I don't do standard emergency medicine anymore, but I don't get it, why we think this is a good thing. If you're truly ill, you should want to wait 6 hours to make sure nothing's missed. And yes, you might, you know, want to be doing other things with those 6 hours than staying in the emergency department. But in the grand scheme of things, if you were actually sick, that was a good move. If you're really caring about your time, if you'd rather be going and getting some errands done and getting out as quickly as possible, you probably did not need to come to the emergency department. You probably weren't ill enough to actually show up at a place that's supposed to be treating emergent patients. So I don't get this paradigm. You know, moving fast is the mark of skill, but rushing is the mark of a failed system. And I just, everywhere I go in the United States in emergency medicine, I see people rushing. and I think it's bad. But this is a diversion away from the main topic. But the point is, those patients are better off waiting while you deal with your backlash. So what you don't do is see a patient. What you do instead is first get something to eat. Get something small. You don't want a big meal here because that's going to make the weariness, the sleepiness even worse. But eat something. Eat a power bar. Eat a small snack. Drink. You won't even know, but you are thirsty. You are absolutely in need of some liquid. So go away from the department for a second if you can. If you could step away and go eat and drink something. It's not a horrible idea if your body is capable of falling asleep afterwards to just get a caffeinated drink. It will really counter that dump of parasympathetic hormones. If you've got even a drop of blood or vomit or other fluids on you, even betadine, go change your scrubs. This is a remarkable, this action has remarkable effects. And I do this routinely, even if I stay clean during the recess. You kind of have that flop sweat on you, even if you don't realize it. And the act of just going and changing into a new pair of scrubs, I mean, it's just like a whole new outlook on everything that's happened. You've basically taken a definitive step to moving forward after that, what can be a rather traumatic incident. So I like doing this. I'm lucky enough to have an office, and I have a pile of 10 clean scrubs in there, and I'll just go and put on a new pair. And, the way scrubs really should work is there should be a machine in the hospital, should be laundering these things. And so if that's the case, then by all means, get a new pair, put them on, chuck your old ones into the bin. This hasn't taken place in many shops, but if it is in yours, taking a 15-minute nap at this point may be the best thing you could ever do. I don't have a place where I could do that, but this is actually a perfect time to do that. And the compilation effects of sleeping at this is probably really beneficial to everyone involved with you and the care you're going to provide. So if you could do that, great. All right. So let's say you've done all those things. You've gotten a candy bar. You've gotten a cup of coffee. You've changed your scrubs. Again, I'm not in a place where napping is really realistic. So you've taken your 10, 15 minutes, you come back. All right, you reassess, the department's still okay. You recheck your patient if they're still there. You make sure everything's going well in that. The next move is to debrief. And this is an incredibly important part of emergency medicine that I think a lot of places are not utilizing. Get everyone involved with that stressful resuscitation together. And it's tough. That everyone needs to be taking care of other patients. It's worth it. You're going to do this for 5 minutes. You're not going to do a 40-minute breakdown of the entire thing. You might do that eventually in a conference setting, but now just grab 5 minutes, get everyone involved and say, what did everyone think? Was there anything that could have been done differently or better? Is anyone holding in their minds, a fear that something was done wrong or a question about why things went a certain way that they just aren't really comfortable vocalizing? Make them comfortable. Make this an environment in your ED or your ICU where people get that it's okay to speak their minds at this point. And if there was a mistake by someone other than you, because we'll discuss what to do when there was a mistake by you in just a sec, but if there's a mistake by someone other than you, it's my belief, and this is my belief, I don't have proof of this, that having them discuss it now, having them almost do a confessional, is a guilt release. That if you don't have them in a venue where it's understood that they're admitting a mistake, and I think this should be public. It shouldn't be public, broadcast over the overhead, but amongst all the people involved, they never get a guilt release. And it's funny because in Maryland, at Shock Trauma, you had to present your own morbidity mortality each week. Anything you screwed up on Monday, you would sit there in front of Dr. Scalia or the other folks who were representing him, and you would say, here's how I fucked up. And it was enormously beneficial. You might think, if you've never done this before, that it's actually harmful. You have to present, it's in front of an entire group of like 40 people. No, it was just the opposite. Once you said it, and people didn't shun you, and they didn't kick you out of the program, and you admitted it out loud, and yeah, maybe they said that was dumb, and maybe they said, no, I've done that before, but regardless of which way it went, you went home and felt, I have put this issue to rest. People know I made this mistake, it's not secret anymore, it's out there, and they still talk to me, they still treat me as if I'm not an idiot, and therefore I'm done. I'll still process the actual clinical care and improve on that, but the actual confessional has been performed. I don't think in many places we offer that to people, and I think therefore they hold it inside, and they feel that people are looking at them badly, and they never get a release. I personally think guilt release is important, and this is the time to do it. Say, you know, give people an environment where they could say, yeah, I really fucked up that intubation. I feel bad. Do you think it made the patient's outcome worse? And either way, them saying that all of a sudden has beneficial effects. And then you could take them aside afterwards and talk to them about, you know, what they could have done differently clinically. You know, here's how you should have held the laryngoscope. Here's what you should have done. That doesn't need to be done in front of the group. But just that releasing of the guilt and having people acknowledge it and go on, I think is incredibly important. And I'd love to hear your comments about whether you think differently or agree. In New York State, you are not allowed to present your own M&Ms. So I think my poor residents are being done an enormous disservice for not having this capability. All right, if you were the one who fucked up or you think you fucked up, there's actually some people that listen to MCRT that don't like me cursing, so I'm sorry. I'll try to stop. It won't happen, but I'll try. If you screwed up, this is also a good time to just say that. And we'll talk about what to do internally later on. But just say, you know, guys, I don't think it was perfect the way I tried to start that central line and then failed. And then the patient didn't have access for a while. And again, release the guilt. Just say it. People respect you more for it, not less. All right. You finish off that shift. What do you do when you get home? Well, if you do think you made a mistake and you're at the attending level, then you got to go on the couch. What do I mean by that? Well, you know, Cliff Reed, you know, really popularized this idea in my head, which is you need a friend who you trust clinically, a friend in medicine who you think whatever they say is going to have value to you, that they're an excellent clinician. Cliff came to me. I would go to Cliff. He's the one I want to be on the couch with. And you got to talk over the case. Now, it could be someone in your own shop. Now, there's a whole bunch of stupid malpractice stuff in the United States regarding this stuff. You don't even get to talk through a case except in the venue of quality assurance. So make sure you qualify it over that. You know, and I'm not going to go into the legalities of this stupidity. The point is, make sure you're safe, you know, because they can call that person to testify unless it's really in the venue of a quality assurance activity. But find someone to talk about the case with. If you're a resident, then find an attending you trust. Go to them. You should have already identified that, even if you're only a first year. Early on in your career, identify the attending you could go to and talk about clinical stuff and know they're going to give you an opinion you trust and they're not going to make you feel stupid. And that doesn't necessarily have to be the attending involved in the actual case, though you might want to talk to them as well. Next thing to do, visualization. Walk through, and I try to do this early on. I try to do it, you know, unless it was a late night shift where I really should just go to sleep. But early on afterwards, I like to visualize minute by minute exactly what happened and look through as pretending I'm performing it de novo. Was there anything that could have gone differently? Was there anything I want to write down as an improvement for my unit? And I just keep going through that and I replay the scene and I ask myself, you know, should I be acting differently this time around? Is there anything I could have improved on? Now, if it was particularly stressful or there was a mistake made by you, then you got to do some other stuff because this can really haunt you for a while and kind of screw up your practice unless you do the right stuff. There's no actual literature on this, but I fervently believe it. I think meditation could be extremely helpful here. If you've been listening to the show, know I talk about meditation a lot. And for me, meditation's not spiritual. It's not, you know, anything except a pure mental exercise. You know, you kettlebell for your core and you meditate for your brain. It's pure, absolute, rational performance activity. I think meditation could be extremely helpful. And when I have had a stressful situation, I will, early on afterward, attempt to meditate. I'm not going to talk about that any further because I actually want to do a podcast about it in the future. And again, there's no literature about it, so I don't want to dwell on it. I personally find it extremely helpful. So early on after one of these situations, I will do one of my meditation sessions. It's only about 10 minutes, And I think it could really help in the processing of this stuff if you go into the meditation stressed and recounting what happened and then process it by meditating. And for me, that meditation is going to be pure breath following, and I'll do that for 10 minutes. And I think it helps with that traumatic processing. Now, what I do have literature for, and this is kind of, you know, you're not going to believe it, but, you know, not just one study, two studies on this, is as soon afterwards as possible, after a traumatic or stressful situation, playing a computer game, and the one that was actually studied is Tetris, though the people involved in this kind of research say Minecraft may work as well, though I've never played Minecraft, so I don't know, but Tetris definitely has been studied. Playing Tetris soon afterwards will have enormous beneficial effects on preventing post-traumatic stress disorder along the visuospatial axis. A lot of PTSD is actual visual, either flashbacks or subliminal perception of the visual component of the stressful situation. Seemingly, playing Tetris will ameliorate those effects. And you should do it right afterwards. One study was on that. These studies are in the show notes, mcrit.org/163. And then even if it's been a while, it's been a day or so, picturing the event in your head, doing that mental visualization, reactivating the stress situation, which is what's going to happen if you visualize something where you made a mistake or there was a bad outcome, and then playing Tetris seemingly works as well. Read the studies. This seems really cool. It's easy. If it turns out not to work, you haven't wasted anything except 5 minutes of your time playing Tetris, which is probably pretty good for your brain anyway. Now, someone who talks about this a lot is a researcher named Jane McGonigal. She is a game processing researcher and a game creator. Actually, I don't even know if she's a researcher. I know she creates games. I don't know if she does research on them or just discusses research on them. But she gave a TED Talk I have linked. That's fantastic. She wrote a book that's on my list of books to read called Super Better, which is how she recovered from post-concussive syndrome using gamification. This stuff is really cool. I'm going to talk about it further on the show with Mike Loria. But I think this is really a great way to process things after bad stuff happened. Now, if you actually screwed up, there's probably some other really good stuff. I'm not an expert on this area. I know an expert on this area. His name's Jason Brooks. He's spoken at the last SMAC. I think he's going to be speaking at the next one. I'm going to bring him on the show. Hopefully, he'll listen to this episode and tell me all the places I've gone wrong and then fill in all the blanks. All right, so we're running a little bit over. I'm going to stop there. What do you think? I mean, this is really an area not spoken about a lot. What do you do after a stressful resuscitation? What should we be doing? Do you think any of the stuff I've said is crap? I want to hear from you. Go to mcrit.org/163 and put them in the comments section on the blog. Scott Weingart, MCRIT Podcast, saying bye-bye.